Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome back. It's the Cigar Country Morning Ride. We're back for our Tuesday edition of the show. It is 6:05. Currently, it's been about 62 degrees here in the Sierra Valley. We got highs in the 80s all week. We could be seeing this at about 90 degrees this weekend. Finally, we're in the spring in southern New Mexico. That also means we have our Gomez guest, Gomez. Coming up at about 6:40 this morning, we've got those birthday babies to give shout out to.
Well, good morning. Thanks for joining me, and everything's up to speed here this morning, technically. There are some troubled days. Troubled days for the Obamacare replacement plans, and the CBO says that the plan is going to be the new unaffordable care plan. So there's a lot of work to be done to fix this thing. And, you know, what can you say? You've got a system that is broken from the start. And in addition to that, you've got fixes that were not really ready, which I don't really blame anybody for. If Obamacare brought in it brought in elements into the market that were not just bad, but were catastrophic in terms of their impact, then they have to be dealt with. But, you know, I mean, here's the one thing that I think a lot of people will look at and point fingers at is that you shouldn't say, I mean, in a sense, you have to say on one hand that we've got a plan that is ready to roll out. On the other hand, because you don't want to present the public with problems that can't be solved. On the other hand, you don't want to, come in and not have a plan. And I think as opposed to there not being a plan, there was a lot of different ideas, some of them that were in conflict, and they had to kind of work them out. And then you've got some people that are more liberal than others proposing their plans. Paul Ryan is a more liberal person, say, than Rand Paul. So it's going in the right direction. It's got to be fixed. And one of the things that the president said would be very important was that it's okay to stand back and let the whole thing collapse, which there may be something to gain politically in the sense of ownership. You know, we came in, this thing was already there. It blew up on the launch pad. It's been, you know, it's been wildly burning, and now it's got to be replaced. But at the same time, you know, you have to think of the individuals. Here's the statements that the president said about this.
And I think it'll bring it down very significantly. Unfortunately, it takes a while to get there, because you have to let that marketplace kick in. And it's going to take a little while to get there. Once it does, it's going to be a thing of beauty. I wish it didn't take a year or 2 years, but that's what's going to happen, and that's the way it works. But we're willing to go through that process. Working together, we'll get the job done. And I have to say this just in closing, and then I want to hear some of your stories, and we'll let the press stay for your stories, if you like. But the press is making Obamacare look so good all of a sudden. I'm watching the news. Looks so good. They're showing these reports about this one gets so much and this one gets so much. First of all, it covers very few people. And it's imploding. And 17 will be the worst year. And I said it once, I'll say it again, because Obama's gone. You know, things are going to be very bad this year for the people with Obamacare. They're going to have tremendous increases. And the Republicans, frankly, are putting themselves in a very bad position. I tell this to Tom Price all the time, by repealing Obamacare, because people aren't going to see the truly devastating effects of Obamacare. They're not going to see the devastation in 17 and 18 and 19. It'll be gone by then. It'll, whether we do it or not, it'll be imploded off the map. So the press is making it look so wonderful, so that if we end it, everyone's going to say, oh, remember how great Obamacare used to be. Remember how wonderful it used to be. It was so great. It's a little bit like President Obama. When he left, people liked him. When he was here, people didn't like him so much. That's the way life goes. That's human nature. The fact is, Obamacare is a disaster. And I say this to Republicans all the time, by repealing it, by getting rid of it, by ending it, everyone's going to say, oh, it used to be so great. But it wasn't great. And I tell Tom Price, and I tell Paul Ryan, I tell every one of them, I say the best thing you can do politically is wait a year, because it's going to blow itself off the map. But that's the wrong thing to do for the country. It's the wrong thing to do for our citizens. So with that, I'd like to introduce some of the folks, and you could say a few words.
All right, so I think that we need to understand what was going on. If Trump doesn't win, then you've got an unmitigated disaster that's not going to be fixed. And so now that these guys are in there, I mean, I just assume that it's harder than what people thought, and what people were thinking was that we'll just, you know, kill this thing and here's the thing. When you fool with a market, when you screw around with a market, and you can see this in these communist countries that had communism and socialism for 80 years, 50 years, whatever it was, that the market is deformed. You know, it's like putting somebody in shoes and not upgrading, you know, putting a kid in shoes and then not buying new shoes. And the kid always has to wear the same shoes and their feet get stunted, you know? And so that's what happens to these markets, is these markets are destroyed and they have to rebuild. They rebuild on their own to a large extent, like he was saying. That's the power of capitalism. And the shame in this country is that there is not deep teaching, widespread teaching of capitalistic principles, because, you know, it's a beautiful system and it capitalizes on the freedom and ingenuity of human beings. But if you don't teach people about capitalism, then you've got all of these smart alecks that are growing up saying, and I just saw a clip of this last night, we're a lot farther to the left, we're a lot more socialistic, our generation. Well, good for you. But you're going to find out the same thing. Your love and support, the millennial love and support of socialism, if it's out there, doesn't change the facts on the ground. It just doesn't change reality. That's like, you know, somebody from the millennial generation getting up and saying, the millennial generation is not a fan of gravity. Well, all right. Good for you. So does that mean, are you going to use the law to get rid of gravity? All right. So here's a little bit from Schmuck Schumer, on the CBO report on the budget. The government budget, and there are claims in the Trump administration that the CBO is cooking the books to make the plan look worse than it really is. I don't know about that, but here's Schumer.
Thank you very much, and I want to thank Leader Pelosi for her great words. Now, the Republican handpicked head of CBO has confirmed what we Democrats have been saying all along. Trump care would be a nightmare for the American people, causing tens of millions to lose coverage and millions more seeing the costs of their health care going up. 10 years.
All right. So my initial reaction is, why not put those people under Medicaid? You know, I mean, instantly, if you want to break the fall of these people, put them under Medicaid and figure out a way if they can, for whatever they can pay into it. What else are they going to do?
Here's from today. If President Trump and the Republicans have their way, there would be 24 million more Americans without health insurance, a total of 58 million Americans living in this country 10 years from now will not have health coverage. That's un-American. That's wrong. Premiums for seniors will rise a whopping 20 to 25%. And co-payments and deductibles for millions more. If there was ever a war on seniors, this bill, Trump Care, is it. The bill spends almost twice as much on tax cuts for the wealthy compared to tax credits to help older middle-class Americans afford health insurance. The rich get $592 billion in tax cuts for the richest, compared to only $361 billion for the middle class and the working class to afford health care. So when Speaker Ryan says it's an act of mercy, yeah, for those people who make over $250,000 a year, because they get big tax cuts.
All right, so I don't really have the stomach to listen to this guy. But anyway, so the statement is out there that Obamacare is, or the replacement for Obamacare is, is a failure. So let me ask you this. How did we get here? How did we get here? And I've got a little clip here from Rebel Media.
Just a quick note about something other than Canadian politics. Let's talk about American politics, even just for a moment. Back in 2009, Barack Obama nationalized U.S. healthcare. He brought 1/7 of the U.S. economy under government control. It was an odd thing to do, and he didn't campaign on it in 2008, but it was important to him. Obviously, he did this at great cost. Huge hikes in insurance premiums, and in some cases, strict rules limiting which doctors Americans can choose. It was awful from a patient's point of view, but in 2009, Obama told Congress that, quote, there are now more than 30 million American citizens who cannot get coverage, unquote. That's why he was nationalizing it, to give them insurance coverage. By the way, just because you don't have insurance coverage doesn't mean you can't get health care, but that's a different point. That was the rationale, though. 30 million people needed insurance. But look at this news now. According to a new study by the nonpartisan Kaiser Family Foundation, quote, 32.3 million non-elderly people lacked health coverage in the U.S. So that's more. One-sixth of the economy was nationalized. The entire health insurance industry was destroyed, and with it, consumer choice. The doctor-patient relationship was replaced with a bureaucrat-patient relationship. And the whole excuse of the thing, the whole raison d'etre, insuring uninsured Americans, well, 5 years later, and the problem is actually worse. But you see, to Obama, this is not a disaster. It's a huge win. He got what he wanted, a large new government department, billions more in government spending, and the state injected into the private lives of every American. That wasn't just the process. It wasn't just the means to an end. It was the goal itself. And more than that, the fact that the problem of uninsured people is still a problem, and even worse, why, that means soon they'll need maybe Obamacare Part 2, or maybe it'll be called Hillary Care, or as we call it up here, Canadian-style taxes with Canadian-style medical waiting lists. For the Rebel.media, I'm Ezra Levant.
All right, so that was a year ago. Here's another clip from a year ago, why Obamacare has been a financial failure. What I'm trying to point out here is the most obvious point in the world, which is we're in the situation we're in because of the radical decisions made by the government, the just complete indifference to any criticism. And just, you know, anybody who criticized Obamacare was a hater. They were racist. They didn't care about the poor. They didn't know anything. My buddy Bryce, who's been on the show a number of times, said he'd read the whole bill. Did he read the bill? I don't really know. I wasn't there watching him, but, you know, 2,000-page health bill, I have my doubts. But, I mean, and, you know, he's telling me it's workable. How many pages is the Constitution, you know? So why does the health care bill need to be 2,500 pages long? But anyway, here's a little bit from Fox on that.
Facts to back up the notion that President Obama's health care reform has been a financial failure. Correspondent Rich Edson looks at the disturbing events that are costing you and your fellow Americans some serious money.
More than $1 billion wasted and $1 billion more owed. That's the assessment of the majority staff of the Senate Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations and its report on the Obamacare cooperatives. The details were first reported by Fox News.
What we found out is that a lot of bad decisions were made.
Obamacare created 23 nonprofit cooperatives, insurance companies designed to increase competition and lower costs. More than half have failed. The administration loaned $2.4 billion to these co-ops. The failed dozen borrowed $1.2 billion of that. The committee report says they have repaid nothing to the government and in addition owe doctors, hospitals, and others more than $1 billion. At a Thursday hearing, administration officials refused to confirm the full report, saying officials are still reviewing it.
You're a smart guy. Why should we be having to give you the numbers that are publicly available? Get the numbers yourself.
The committee report also claims by the end of 2014, the failed co-ops exceeded their projected worst-case scenario losses by more than $260 million. It also claims from 2014 to 2015, the administration lent an additional $848 million to the failed cooperatives as they lost more than $1.4 billion.
So I'm not asserting that anyone here is evilly motivated, but whether or not anybody's competent to oversee this program, I haven't seen any evidence of that yet.
Today, more than 90% of Americans have health coverage, and even in states where co-ops proved unsuccessful, in the first year, the overall uninsured rate decreased by 20% and has continued to improve.
Financial failure. Correspondent Rich.
So it doesn't matter who has health care. It matters how much it costs, and it matters what it does. I mean, you know, if you turn American healthcare into the veterinary clinic, you know, nobody's going to gain anything. But I just want us to remember, And I don't understand why these people, I know the Trump people are very smart, but why is it that they don't play these clips like this one?
9 million people that you refer to that might have to change their coverage, keep in mind out of the 300 million Americans that we're talking about, would be folks who the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, estimates would find the deal in the exchange better. Would be a better deal. So they would change coverage because they've got more choice and competition. Would be a better deal because they've got more choice and competition. Would be a better deal because they.
All right, so what is a utopia? A utopia is the idea of building heaven on earth.
It's going to be great.
You're going to build heaven on earth, and the heaven is going to be cheaper. It's going to be more prosperous. And so, the Obamacare was a utopian idea, and you might say, well, Kelly, why do you criticize somebody's trying to make something better? When it's built on transparent lies, what do you expect? When it harms everybody, and this guy gets on the show a year ago and says even in the states where these government established, I'm trying to remember what they called them, but some states put them together. In other states, the feds put them together, and the exchanges, they all failed. And in some of these states, they put in $500 million or $1 billion, and they still failed. Why? Because it was not financially workable. If the market doesn't create an economic outcome, you've got to be careful, because the market feels along. It has to look for affordable things on the way, because businesses go out of business if they don't do that. Here's another statement from the president.
It's going to bring down skyrocketing costs. It's going to save families money. It's going to save businesses money. It's going to save government money. We'll still get it. It's just they'll see it a little cheaper.
Premiums are going to be lower. Healthcare costs overall are going to be lower.
Affordable, quality health insurance at a significantly cheaper rate than what they can get right now on the individual market.
So where is the excoriation? Where is the attacking against this guy that should be out there? You might say, well, he's not in the office anymore. It doesn't matter. Well, Obama spent years attacking Bush for his mistakes. So why not, so that may not be the answer, but it would be a little bit satisfying when you've got, the Democrats coming to feast off the failure of Trump care that hasn't even been built yet. They're really feasting on themselves, aren't they? These buzzards, these jackals, these hyenas that are coming around. I find it hilarious. You destroyed the system. The people on the right warned you about that. They begged you not to do it. You passed it on a pure party vote. Turned out to be a complete catastrophe, and then somebody's trying to fix it and you're making fun of them. That is pathetic. 626 Kelly O'Connell, AM Las Cruces, 523 1450 and 805-6180. I got my little tax buddy with me. We'll be right back. It is the 14th of March. So don't forget how we got to where we're at, which is right here.
Then you can keep your plan if you are satisfied with it.
If you like the plan you have, you can keep it.
I intend to keep this promise. If you like your health care plan, you'll be able to keep your health care plan.
If you like your plan and your doctor, you can keep them.
You'll be able to keep your health care plan.
If you like your plan, you keep your plan.
If you like your doctor, you like your plan, you can keep your doctor. You can keep your plan.
If you like your current insurance, you keep that insurance. Period. End of story.
If you've got health insurance...
I can't even listen to all these. There's 36 of them. It's sickening to hear this stuff. Let's be honest here. The reason that we're in this position is because of the recklessness, the madness for power, the complete lack of reasonableness. You know, the Harry Reid's, the Nancy Pelosi's. Nancy Pelosi acts like she's poisoned by all the plastic surgery she's had. Now, here is just one more on the costs. So,
a system where we're going to work with your employers to lower your premiums by up to $2,500 per family per year.
We will start by reducing premiums by as much as $2,500 per family.
Here's what changes, saying to people who already have health insurance and the employers who are providing it, we'll work to lower your premiums by up to $2,500 per family per year.
I also have a health care plan that would save the average family $2,500 on their premiums.
And if you already have health care, then we're going to reduce costs an average of $2,500 per family on premiums.
We're going to work with your employer to lower the costs.
All right, another clip. I can't even listen to the whole thing. Now, what did Obama achieve? What's the Frankie answer? I don't know how big of a fan Frankie turned out to be. Frankie only texts now. He doesn't call in and crow and celebrate. But Trumper is not smart is his last message to me. But what did Obama achieve? I mean, is it worthwhile to get someone who's black in as president? All things being equal, I'm sure it was. But what did he achieve? I mean, was the vote for Obama just proof to all of these liberals? I mean, I understand if you're black and you vote for Obama because, wow, we finally have somebody representing us. And I don't resent that. That's human nature to support people that are more like you, but all of the crazy leftists who voted for him so that they could prove to themselves and prove to their families, their future generations, that they weren't racist, there has to be a higher standard than that, right? So what did the Democrats achieve by putting him in there? How did he benefit the country? What achievements did he get? Obamacare is now seen as a complete and total failure based on lies. Now, you can attack the Republicans for trying to replace it. I think, though, functionally speaking, it has to be replaced because it doesn't work, you know? So if you supported bringing in Trump, and I'm sure there's a number, Obama, there's a number of people listening who voted for Obama at least the first time and listened to his soaring rhetoric, his supposedly soaring rhetoric. What was achieved? Did you get out of what you wanted for your vote? I mean, Obama is a classic case of a guy who should have gone to Hollywood. He should have gone there because he's good at reading a script. He talks about stuff constantly he doesn't know anything about, and he makes promises based on nothing. He doesn't, you know, he didn't know anything about government when he got in there and he let Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid run the government and create programs and spending bills to the ruin of the entire country. Here's let's take a break. And I know this sounds like a sickening, and it is, in fact, a sickening experience to go back and listen to these people. But these are the same people. Nancy Pelosi's still around. She's almost 80. She's 78. And she's still around. She refuses to apologize. And now she's just waiting for the failure of Trump Care. Be right back to listen to that. All right, so I know this is agonizing, but I think it is worth, it's worth playing this stuff. I mean, it's just so terrible to listen to these people. I mean, Nancy Pelosi has got to be, she has to have mental, problems. And so I've been studying recently about, some of these cognitive biases people have. And I really feel like, we all have biases, so it's not like you're going to get rid of your biases, but you could at least try to be aware of them, Here's Nancy.
Are saying, discrediting the CBO, and others are glorifying pushing 24 million people off of coverage. So I hope that they would pull the bill. It's really the only decent thing to do. Numbers are important. They see the numbers. They should know how that transfers into people's lives. They are finding that out from their constituents. How can they look their constituents in the eye when they say to them, 24 million of you are no longer going to have coverage? And those of you who do have it will have less in terms of coverage at more cost to you. With that, I'm pleased to yield to the distinguished Democratic leader of the Senate. Welcome back to the House side, my colleague.
18 happy years. Or actually, 14.
So, I mean, what is wrong with Nancy Pelosi that she always puts these big smiles on all of her statements? Is she in high school? Is she a cheerleader? I mean, what is wrong with this person? And where, I mean, the main thing is when I look at her, she reminds me of somebody off of Mad TV or Saturday Night Live or something who plays a housewife who's become mentally ill, you know? The way she talks and makes faces and grimaces to smile and acts like she's doing the, you know, the universe a favor. Where is her sense of response? You created this. You created this, and now we've all got to sit around and suffer underneath it. But you're willing to attack the person who has to come in. It's like, you know, you go in somebody's house and poop on the floor, and then you attack the person that comes and cleans it up. I mean, this is so insane. Nancy Pelosi, Nancy Polluted, which is probably Frankie's real mother. Hear that, Frankie? Must be a mentally ill person. What other possible, you know? So here's Nancy. What she's willing, here's a question. What is a nutbag willing to do to pass health care?
But we have to pass the bill so that you can find out what is in it away from the fog of the controversy.
That's an insane idea. You're going to pass a law so you can find out what's in it? That's like somebody with a peanut allergy has to eat their dinner to find out if there's peanuts in it. All right, here she is again.
We go through the gate. The gate's closed. We'll go over the fence. The fence is too high. We'll pole vault in. If that doesn't work, we'll parachute in, but we're going to get health care reform passed for the American people, for their own personal health and economic security.
Do you feel more secure now with your health care? And do you like the fact that Nancy Pelosi, employed the Marines to bring in health care to America?
We go through the gate. The gate's closed. We'll go over the fence. The fence is too high. We'll pole vault in. If that doesn't work, we'll parachute in. But we're going to get health care reform passed for the American people, for their own personal health and economic security.
Somebody who is functionally insane, possibly, led the health care charge. Now, here's a... listen to David Gregory take her on this.
Companies must tell the policyholder what they are deprived of, that they're not getting a pre-existing condition.
But there are cancellation notices going out. There's a million of them in California.
Yeah, and it's not. And what they have to do now is to send another letter that says, this is what this is going to mean to you in terms of you won't get pre-existing condition discrimination. And here are the other options that are available to you in the marketplace.
But the president has been apologetic. He's been accountable for saying something that was not the case. You were Speaker of the House. You, in many ways, were seen as an architect and a key ally on this. And this is what you said back in June of 2009 on MSNBC.
What we are talking about is affordable, quality, accessible health care for all Americans. It's about choice. If you like what you have and you want to keep it, you have the choice to do that.
Are you accountable for saying something that turned out not to be correct?
Well, it's not correct. It's that if you want to keep it, and it's important for the insurance company to say to people, this is what your plan does. It doesn't prevent you from being discriminated against on the basis of pre-existing conditions. It doesn't lifetime limits, annual limits, and the
There's
rest.
There's a bottom
of that.
Line to this, which I think people understand and the president has acknowledged, which is if there are not, the government has decided there have to be minimum standards that are minimum. Requirements in any healthcare plan.
Yeah.
So if you have something and you like it and it doesn't meet what the government says you have to have, you cannot keep it.
If you
and that's
had,
not what you said
If
here.
You had your plan before the enactment of the law in 2010, if you had your plan before, there is nothing in the law that says you have to. But, you know, again,
We can go back and forth and this.
Right, but this is an important deal because the grandfathering has changed. And the bottom line is the president has acknowledged, it doesn't seem like you're acknowledging, that saying to people back in 2009, hey, this is going to be easy. If you like what you have, you can keep it. It's all about choice.
You could, if you had your plan until the enactment of the law in 2000. Any pre-grandfathering is for those before 2000. But let me say this, and I commend the president. He's gracious, and he's taking responsibility. But that doesn't mean that there was anything in the law that said if you like what you had before 2010, you couldn't keep it.
She looks like somebody who's been caught at enemy lines and is trying to avoid getting executed, you know. Name, rank, and serial number. What are you up to? Why are you here? Blah, 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 blah. I'm Nancy Pelosi. And, you know, she puts out these thought patterns without connective words. I mean, listening to her is just reminds me of Porky. But Porky's Pledge Allegiance.
Yes, pledge allegiance to the flag, and I pledge allegiance to the flag of the.
All right, so let's we'll take another break here, but I mean, this is the leadership that the Democratic Party has forced on America. Who is Nancy Pelosi? I mean, she's like somebody who escaped from like a schizophrenic or some sort of a megalomaniac escaped from a mental institute and got into power. And, you know, she was too effective for the Democrats to take out of power. We'll take a little break here, a little Dire Straits, Water of Love. We'll be back, folks. It's not going to be all day of clips that make you want to vomit and go see if your Obamacare still works. We'll be right back.
I am dry in the long, hot day. Lost and lonely every way. Other people.
Here's from Frankie. Deflect, obfuscate, and just plain lie. That's all you cons got. Nancy is more sane than your Cheeto colored man. Sick, sick, sick. Can't talk about. So you insult mothers. You can't talk about Donald John Trump. Typical con kookiness. You come across as so wussy and immature. Thanks, Frankie. Sounds like I'm improving in your book. More. Oh, okay. Well, somebody texted me this. I was mentioned on national radio yesterday on the Robert Davey show, but one of your fans, gentleman caller, told Robert Davey your radio voice is being sabotaged because of your conservative opinions in this uber liberal progressive town. That's not true, right? It's purely a business decision. Yeah, I mean, the guy that bought this station is he's conservative, so business decision. I don't know what would change. I talked to him a couple of days ago, and I thought the change was going to be like this month, but I guess it's not going to be. So Darby comes on Savage after KOBE. Darby gets calls often from Patriots and Cruises. So whoever called in and mentioned me, thank you. And Frankie, I'm going to start a fund here to pay for some depends for you because you're obviously, this whole thing is throwing you over the edge. All right, here's Jim Jordan on Obamacare repeal and replacement. Jim Jordan, big Tea Party. Look, this is our chance to influence, so don't be afraid to call up Steve Pearce and let him know how you feel.
Is heating up. Sources tell CNN the White House is privately backing an earlier rollback of Medicaid expansion. That would be a major win for the most conservative members of.
I'll be totally honest. I don't see this thing getting solved piece by piece. The only thing I think we can do is put Medicaid out there to cover a lot of these people and then back it off, figure out a way, you know, to either pay for it better or figure out a way to get people off on the private insurance. But you can't drop a bunch of people. It's, you know, politically, it would be a death sentence to the GOP, but it would also be, unfair to these people who trusted the president, people like Frankie.
Congress. Let's bring in one of them, Republican Congressman Jim Jordan of Ohio, the co-founder of the House Freedom Caucus, opposed to the health care bill, as is. He met with the president yesterday. Congressman, always a pleasure to have you on the show.
Good to be with you again, Chris.
All right, so let me give you a little refresher on some sound by the Speaker of the House with where he sees this moment.
Sure. This is the closest we will ever get to repealing and replacing Obamacare. The time is here. The time is now. This is the moment, and this is the closest this will ever happen. It really comes down to a binary choice.
Speaker Ryan, channeling Macklemore there. Tonight is the night. We'll fight till it's over. So we put our hands up. The ceiling line, not as relevant from that song to this current situation. But he's trying to make you guys feel like you can blow this. Get on board with this plan. It's better than what's there now. You are with Pelosi and Obama. Do you accept that?
No, we're with the American people. We're going to do what we told them we were going to do. And to set this up as a binary choice, we just got this bill 72 hours ago. The American people first saw this bill 72 hours ago. And to say that we can't amend it, change it, and make it right, that just doesn't make – that's not how the legislative process works. I represent 750,000 people in the 4th of Ohio. They want me to weigh in. I'm not on the Energy and Commerce Committee. I'm not on the Ways and Means Committee, and I'm not on the Budget Committee. So we want to influence this bill, change this bill, make this bill consistent. with what we told the voters we were going to do. I bet there's a lot of members. In fact, I know there's a lot of members who don't want this binary choice. They want to weigh in and be part of the legislative process.
Well, look, the other thing that Ryan is saying, and again, he seems to be carrying water for the White House on this, is you had your chance. We've been looking at this for a year. Everybody was asked to weigh in. We took everybody's ideas. This is what we agreed on. And now you're not on the team.
And nowhere in the better way.
All right. So we don't have enough time to go through that, but you get the idea. There's a plan. We had an opportunity to bring it in. It's a massive subject. There's a different ideas to stick it in there. I mean, that's where you find out what these people are made out of. And you get to know that Paul Ryan is a relatively liberal Republican, and the people of the Tea Party, like Jim Jordan, are less liberal. And so they're fighting for, and it's how your ideals impact your decision making. And, you know, you can talk about cognitive bias or whatever, but there's also the impact of just your ideals. I mean, I'll get into a little bit of cognitive bias in the next hour. I'm going to jump on the idea of populism and Jackson, who was President Jackson. Here's a little bit big head dedicated to Frankie. Frankie just said he's not poor. And, but Frankie, are you proud of Pelosi? Are you proud of Obama? Are you proud of Harry Reid? I'm just curious. Here we go.
I can't. I took her to the park and kids already, you know, mean to her, you know, a little older, knock her down. No, you're not playing with no. Oh, your heart breaks. Like, I just want to punch that 2-year-old right in the face. What are you doing? You started it. What? I just want to protect her. I don't want to send her out to the world's evil, you know? You're at home, everyone loves you, and they're so nice to you, and they go out in the world, they find that one little thing, and they attack you. Oh, why does your eye do that? Look at this guy's eye. Hey, googly eye. We all go through it. I did. In third grade, I had the same size head I have right now. I used to wake up and tip over. Sucks having a big head, because you can't do anything about it. What am I going to do? Go to the gym? Jump on the head machine?
There you go, Frankie. Do you feel better? All right, we'll take you out here with some Dire Straits. But we've got to replace Obamacare. It's in the midst of happening. We've got to get these people to work for the best plan. And I think it is typical Paul Ryan to try to turn it into, you know, now or nothing. You know, live or die right now. Paul Ryan is not the best that we have in the GOP. 523-1450 to call in on AM Las Cruces. Kelly O'Connell, KOB, will be back. That's all wrong. Sky up above. Yes, I need a little water of love. I'm too long and lonely and my heart feels pain. Crying out. I believe taking up. Yes, I need a little water of love. Good morning. Just spent an hour going over the Obamacare redo into Trump care, I guess they'll call it. And what we found out is that Obamacare is totally screwed up, and Frankie's sitting there at home taking pot shots at me through his text machine. I guess he's too embarrassed about the Democrats to even call in anymore, but so the Democrats created a disaster. Let's just say it was a very poorly planned and executed idea on nuclear weapons or power or something, and they left a total disaster and were discredited for it. The Republicans came in and they've got to deal with the disaster. Would you sit there and point fingers and laugh at them as they were trying to clean it up? Well, you can't use a helicopter. Everybody knows that, you know, and you can't use the military, you know, so there would, so, you know, you can make fun of the Republicans, and I don't think they should be given a freebie because they bought into the problem, but you know, I do think they should be given a little bit of sympathy for what they're trying to do. All right. Cognitive bias. I'm not going to go through all of these. I've got from Business Insider, I've got 20 different cognitive biases. These kind of remind me of fallacies, mistakes in thinking that if you call them out, immediately identify a problem. I'm just going to mention this real briefly. Cognitive bias refers to the systematic pattern of deviation from norm or rationality in judgment, from common sense, in other words, or from doing things the best way, whereby inferences or instincts about other people and situations may be drawn in an illogical fashion. This is hard to follow here. This is from Wikipedia. But they're just mistakes in thinking. And some of the ones that the article in the Business Insider, read a couple of these so you get a feel for them. Anchoring bias. People are overly reliant on the first piece of information they hear. In a salary negotiation, whoever makes the first offer establishes a range of reasonable possibilities in each person's mind. Availability, what they call a heuristic, availability cognitive bias. People overestimate the importance of information that is available to them. A person might argue, for example, that smoking is not unhealthy because they know someone who lived to 100 and smoked 3 packs a day. Bandwagon effect. Here, this is very popular. The probability of one person adopting a belief increases based on the number of people who hold to that belief. This is a powerful form of groupthink and is a reason why meetings are often unproductive. So a very, very typical one is confirmation bias. You already believe something, and then therefore you instinctively and without thinking, kind of subliminally, tend to accept information that agrees with the ideas and beliefs that you already have. So, and that something. These are all things that everybody has to struggle with. So it's kind of interesting. So anyway, we've all got these biases and we just have to kind of work past them. And I think, I hate to say it, might sound unfair, but I think leftism lives off of these biases and doesn't try to move beyond them. Now, all right, so I had mentioned to you, we're going to get into this, what is populism, but Steve King said something that I want to get out there and get your opinion on. If you have an opinion, 523-1450 to call it, 805-6180. It sounds racist. I don't interpret it as racist. What I interpret it as being is the problem that we're in right now, the West is not reproducing. That's why you don't need abortion for people, because there's a lower reproductivity rate in advanced countries. All you have to do is get everybody to an advanced state. You don't need abortion whatsoever. People stop reproducing at a high rate, and especially in the kind of culture that we're in that does use abortion as a birth control, has all kinds of other birth control, and has there are many narratives that have been put out there that it's either a bad idea or it's immoral or unethical to have too many children. So we can't have the kind of a society, the kind of culture that we have right now, if we're replacing the people in our culture with individuals from around the world. It doesn't work that way. So he's stating this, but it's being picked up as racism, but I'll get your opinion on it.
Understand that culture and demographics are our destiny. We cannot restore our civilization with somebody else's babies. This is being condemned by many regions of American politics and citizenry. What did you mean?
Well, of course, I meant exactly what I said, as it always is the case, Chris. And to expand on that a little further, I've been to Europe and I've spoken on this issue, and I've said the same thing as far as 10 years ago to the German people and to any population of people that is a declining population that isn't willing to have enough babies to reproduce themselves. And I've said to them, you cannot rebuild your civilization with somebody else's babies. You've got to keep your birth rate up, and that you need to teach your children your values. And in doing so, then you can grow your population and you can strengthen your culture. You can strengthen your way of life.
Who's somebody else's babies?
Chris, we're a country here that, you know, if you take a picture of what America looks like, you can do it in a football stadium or a basketball court, and you see all kinds of different Americans there. Mm. We're pretty proud of that the different looking Americans that are still Americans. And there's an American culture, an American civilization. It's raised within these children in these American homes. And that's one of the reasons why we require that the president of the United States be raised with an American experience.
I mean, because it seemed like you were doing the opposite. Like you were trying to say someone else's babies means you're either white or you're not right. And as you know, that is anathema to what America's all about. Can we get agreement on that?
Well, here's actually, if you go down the road a few generations or maybe centuries with the intermarriage, I'd like to see an America that's just so homogenous that we look a lot the same from that perspective. I think there's been far too much focus on race, especially in the last 8 years. And I want to see that put behind us. And I want to be as bonded together. I gave a speech on this on Saturday, and half the liberals got up and left the room when I talked about
because
the success
when you say,
and
when
unity
you suggest
and putting an end to the divisions.
But when
they're
you
looking
suggest,
for hatred is the point, Chris.
But hold on a second. Congressman, if you suggest that somebody else's babies shouldn't be welcome in a country, you seem inherently divisive. That's why I keep asking you, what was your intention with this? And you keep to seem doubling down on it. I mean, you said America's got lots of different faces. That's fine. But you keep making this.
He just stated that he wants race to go away, that he hopes that everybody becomes one race. What we're talking about here, and that Chris Cuomo, who's the brother of the governor of New York, has to, because he's a liberal, has to jump on the racial aspect of this, even though race is not the point of this, and turn it into a big deal, because that's what liberals do, is they make mountains out of molehills, and then they fall down crying and say the world's not fair and you're an evil person. But, I mean, I think the point is well taken. We have to have people in this country who embrace the culture to move the culture forward. That's a fact. Now, we need people inside the culture already, I think, to reproduce. Race is not relevant. What is relevant is cultural values. You're not going to get a bunch of people from around the world to move here and start living and have a successful culture. There's going to be a transition. And look at what happened in Germany. Now they're talking about deportation or exportation or whatever the phrase is. They're having a continuing number of attacks. They had to close down one of the biggest malls in Germany a couple of days ago because they had heard that somebody was coming to bomb it. So you're bringing in people. And this is the conceit of, and if you want to talk about bias, what are the biases of liberalism? What are the biases is that all people are the same? Well, I mean, that's broadly true, right? But are all cultures the same? That's one of the implications. All people are the same. All people have culture. Therefore, all cultures are the same. Is that true? Of course not. So you've got these individuals who are out fighting. They're exhausting. They're investing their lives in working on making America not just as diverse as possible with as many different races. They're making it as multicultural as possible, in which you pit one culture against the other and let them have a fight. Now, if you have 50% engaged Muslims in what they believe, and you have 50% non-Muslims, who's going to win that battle? Who's willing to fight the hardest? who's willing to go to the most incredible ends to get their way. So the problem in this country, in the West and Europe in general, is you have idiots like Chris Cuomo who insist that we can't really discuss this topic or you're a racist. This is the old card in the deck. What do they say about the race card? It's the last card in the deck. Falling down to this race card, and if you don't agree with them, you're a racist. And in the meantime, they want to take people from around the world, but especially from Muslim countries, and flood them in to these places in Europe that created the rule of law and created rights, the theory of rights, and you know the Bill of Rights, and all the things that we can be proud of in the West. The things that we've created in the West, which supersede race, has been put together by all the races of the people that live in the West, have totally changed the world. Capitalism, art, music, all the things that we've invented. But that has to be flushed down the toilet while bimbos like Chris Cuomo insist that we flood Europe with Muslims to see what happens to prove that all people are alike. Kelly O'Connell will be right back. We'll come back and talk about populism.
Water love, deep in the ground, but there ain't no water here to be found.
523-1450 and 805-6180 to text.
Water of love.
All right, here's a little bit on populism. I did a clip yesterday on populism, and the clip had to do with the populist party that arose at the end of the 1800s and died in the early 1900s. But the ideas move on. Here is a little bit from TRT World. So what is populism? Or is populism on rise in the U.S. and EU? Got that clip here, and I've got something from the Wall Street Journal. I don't agree with all of these, but I'm amazed at the number of clips on populism that are put in there to attack Trump. And this is the kind of bias we're seeing in the media. It's like the media realizes it's been exposed for having this huge bias, for having this slant, this leftism, and they're just going with it. I've never seen anything like it. But here's Wall Street Journal.
White House stands a sculpture of Andrew Jackson, the 7th president of the United States. A reminder that populist insurgencies pitting the common man against a government it sees as privileged elites, what's now termed the establishment, can be successful. He said, the rich and powerful too often bend the axe of government to their own selfish purposes. Here was a president who'd emerged from the Senate bent on truly disrupting the culture of Washington, kicking out government employees, replacing them with his own loyalists, and creating a common man connection to the White House. What do Donald Trump and Senator Bernie Sanders have in common with Andrew Jackson? With the man, not a lot. Neither Mr. Trump, a Queens-born, Manhattan-based...
All right, so there's a little bit on Jackson. Here's on whether it's rising in the U.S. and EU.
A new president elected on a wave of populism. It's a political ideology based on the uprising of people feeling ignored by the privileged and ruling elite. And the movement is not just sweeping the United States.
There's one thing I want to mention here. There is a pr- profound need in the average person to be able to work. And what a lot of the schemes and economic programs, especially leftism, but even, I mean, you know, anybody can put out a bad policy or a bad tax plan or whatever, red tape, all these different things, cut down on the ability of the economy to function normally. Trump was going to come in and pull out a bunch of red tape, but people understand at the gut level, they look around America, we're not working like we could be. We're not productive. And it is the, for the most part, even though Obama will never admit this, it is caused by government mistakes, government misguided government. You know, Obama is going to go down in history, at least for those people who were around him, as an extremely arrogant and self-satisfied person who didn't have any or didn't have much interest in anything beyond himself. And when the economy is failing, he says that's just, you know, that's global. We're in a global market. And this idea that Trump is going to return businesses here, what does he use, a magic wand? And then Trump, even before he gets in office, gets businesses to come back to America. So people understand from their gut that is bad decision-making and policy from the government that is to a great extent impeding the U.S. economy.
Presidential win, the UK's decision to leave the European Union was ushered in on the back of anti-establishment sentiment.
I think people feel that the elites don't know how to get anything done, that they are not in touch with the general population and the way they feel and their fears of just on a day-to-day basis of what's happening with all the just intense interdependence that's going on between countries with globalization, with jobs being lost in different parts of the world.
In Europe, populism is thriving as right-wing nationalist groups like the Front National in France gain momentum. In Germany, support for the anti-Islamist party Alternative for Deutschland is growing as people protest against mass migration.
And definitely right-wing populism in Europe is very dangerous because it's very knee-jerk, it's very reactionary, it's very anti-immigration, it tends to have racist undertones.
But last year's re-election of Greece's left-wing Syriza party is proof populism is not just a right-wing phenomenon.
The US election result has triggered a sense of deja vu here in the United Kingdom as people are reminded of the Brexit decision, which came as a surprise to many. But as we wait to see what sort of legacy populism will leave, it's clear it's a movement that's shaking up politics around the world.
And here's one of the things that I disagree with all of these. I listen to so many different clips on populism. I disagree with this idea that there's this, you know, thing called populism and it's bad, you know, and that it's racist, it's nationalistic, it's military, all these different things. The things that are bad in leftism are so much worse than most of the things in populism. And we have to be talked down to by this idiot class of elites that is failure incarnate. And they refuse. The most irritating thing about leftism is it refuses to recognize and admit and take responsibility for its failures, right? And then when they're not in power because they screwed up so bad, then they just stand around and finger point. Let's get some local news here. 523-1450-805-6180. Kelly O'Connell, AM Las Cruces on KOBE. Somebody texting me to ask me to watch the Snowden movie, which I haven't seen. You know, as time goes by, I'm more and more sympathetic to people like Snowden. When it first happened, it was crazy. I mean, like, who would do that? But how else are we going to find out about the surveillance state? Although, am I saying you shouldn't be punished? I don't know. I'm not certainly not putting that out there. He might, maybe he has to be punished just out of principle, you know. More text. We have a government that's out of control. We know that. I just want to know what we can do about it. Well, the same thing we always do. We got to push back. Kelly, I don't believe our healthcare system can be fixed as long as the insurance and drug industry is calling the shots. But look, we got to fix what we have in front of us. We can't go and make this ideal, you know. We've got to fix Obamacare. You can say you're going to throw out Obamacare, but Obamacare has so torn up the healthcare in this country. You've got to relax a lot of these rules, to cancel these rules, and see what the health market does, which it will be returning, but it takes a while. All right, here's a little bit on Andrew Jackson, which we're going to focus on, and the connection between him and Trump.
Andrew Jackson called himself a Jeffersonian Democrat.
This is a History Channel, by the way.
Thomas Jefferson called Jackson a dangerous man.
Thomas Jefferson didn't like men who bordered on fanaticism. And Jackson seemed to him to be at best uncouth and at worst dangerous. But when you get right down to it, Jackson clearly was a lineal heir to the Jeffersonian legacy.
Number 7, Andrew Jackson, Democrat, 1829 to 1837, 61 years old, from Tennessee.
The hero of the common man, the old hero, Old Hickory. He was the type of man, a complex individual to say the least, as all great individuals are. He detested distinction of privilege. He really felt that he was a voice of the common man.
But we mustn't misconstrue this. It doesn't mean that Jackson tried to find out where public opinion was and then be guided by that. No. Jackson knew what he wanted to do and did it, and then tried to enlist public opinion in support of what it was he wanted to do.
Very few people were in between on Andrew Jackson. They either loved him or hated him.
Andrew Jackson definitely captured the imagination of the common man. He was the first president to be born in a log cabin. He asked to be called General, not Mr. President. He chewed tobacco and smoked a pipe. He was a barroom brawler, a passionate Indian fighter, a gambler who brought his own racehorses to the White House, a duelist with two bullets in his body. He also had a furious temper, but he knew how to use it as a management tool.
He would slam his fist and yell and scream, and then afterwards, when everyone left, he would look to someone and say, they thought I was mad, and this was to get his way.
If politics is personal, it's very, very personal for Andrew Jackson, and it's possible to look at Andrew Jackson's presidency as a war against a number of individuals.
Jackson's war began the moment he took office. Invoking the adage, to the victors go the spoils, Jackson simply cleaned house, firing his enemies and hiring his friends. By doing so, he created the spoils system in Washington. But established Washington society, he soon learned, would not be conquered in a day.
First month in the office, what does he come up against? The Battle of the Petticoats.
All right, so anyway, Jackson was the hero of the Battle of New Orleans, right? So he was a gentleman who had grown up kind of out in the wilderness. He had become trained as an attorney, had worked as an attorney, had risen to some prominence. I believe he fell out of favor, and I've got to go read. I've got a couple of books on him, but I mean, basically speaking, he was a guy that kind of had an indomitable will. And, you know, like a lot of great men, he falls out of favor and then he comes back in favor. And I'm not saying he was a perfect guy by any means. And here is something about him that, you will find a little bit, disquieting. He loved to settle disagreements by duels.
In
It's Andrew Jackson, 7th President of the United States, badass, first class.
Andrew Jackson was a frontier fighter. He fought the British. He survived countless excruciatingly difficult military campaigns. He's one of the most sensational figures of American history. Jackson was quick-tempered and extremely proud. If somebody looked at him the wrong way or somebody impugned his character in any way, he needed satisfaction. And hence we have a serial duelist.
Jackson loved duels. We don't know how many duels he's fought, and historians are split. Some say it's 13, some say there's way more than that, but it's more than most people have duels.
Jackson fought his most famous duel in 1806 with Charles Dickinson. His father-in-law was having a drawn-out feud over a horse bet gone wrong with Jackson. Charles Dickinson stood up for his father-in-law, and the two met with dueling pistols.
Dickinson is an awesome shot. Everybody knows this, including Andrew Jackson. So Jackson, like the insane badass that he was, says, "You can go first." And Andrew Jackson stands there like an oak tree. So the bullet hits Andrew Jackson, cracks his ribs, lands like millimeters away from the guy's heart. But Jackson doesn't go down.
Jackson calmly took out a handkerchief, staunched the wound, said he was okay,
takes his gun out, aims for the heart, bang! Kills him dead. It's hard to pick which is the most badass part of that story. For me, it's him demanding that the guy take the first shot. You might be wondering where the bullet went. Bullet stays in Andrew Jackson. He carried that to the day he died. That's badass.
There's no fight like a duel, and Old Hickory did it best.
All right, so that's Andrew Jackson. Let's take a little break and come back and talk about some connection between Jackson and Donald Trump. And Donald Trump is an anti-establishment. He's in the establishment, obviously, but he's anti-establishment in his sentiments. And that's kind of who Andrew Jackson was. Kelly O'Connelly, AM Las Cruces, AM 1450, 523, 1450, and 805-6180 your text. We'll be right back.
Well, up in the tree,
here's a little bit on the connection between, I mean, there's obvious connections. Number one, two very opinionated people. Two, number two, two self-righteous people, I would say. Number three, both unwilling to put down the gun or the Twitter, want to take it to their enemies and their critics. So, I mean, those are some of your comparisons. But I think, you know, the willingness to go against the entire establishment, which is kind of admirable. Here we go.
The more I see Trump in action, and particularly around his inauguration, he reminds me of Andrew Jackson. And the parallels between the two of them are really astonishing. Both of them were a qualitatively different president from the ones that went before. Jackson was the first president outside of Virginia and Massachusetts, the states that had begun the revolution. He was from Tennessee. He was rough-hewn. He was not a polished man of universities. And he was seen as a ruffian, a heathen. He fought duels. He actually killed two people in duels, and for his entire life had a bullet lodged right near his heart where he'd been shot during a duel. And the concept of a president who used strong executive powers as a man and then as a president to get his way, to force his way on Congress and on the country. And represented a movement of the outsiders. In Jackson's case, it was the Westerners, the frontiersmen who had settled the Western states. In Trump's case, of course, it's the unemployed industrial workers in the Northeast. But in both cases, there's a constituency that felt cut out and let back in by the president. In fact, the inaugurations have a lot in common. Jackson threw the White House open to the public, and thousands, tens of thousands of people came in and marauded through it, ripped the place apart, and junked it. And it took a while to get it back to its former elegant self. Trump's inauguration didn't do that, but it did let into Washington an entire group of people who have been shut out before, who were considered boorish and unmannerly and deplorables, if you will, by the other party. And Jackson was unhesitating in his willingness to use the power of his office, the force of his office, to do what he wanted to do. When the issue came up about rechartering the Bank of the United States, he tried to get Congress to do it, and then he unilaterally pulled Americans' government's money out of the bank and did all kinds of actions to force the bank to die and ultimately killed it after he was reelected on that basis. Trump is going right ahead, implementing his program, taking advantage of his majority and moving very quickly and very affirmatively. There's a quality of taking charge and of aggressive action and of lack of concern about consequences that I think animated both men in a very positive way.
All right, Dick Morris there, and then we have a I'm looking at our time here. Let's come back. Let's take a brief segue here and come back and a few more things to discuss. 523-1450, 805-6180 to text Kelly O'Connell, Dan Musgrove, the same 1450 on KOBE. And just a moment, we'll be right back.
If I don't get some water soon,
I'll be All right. There's one more clip that I want to play for you. We could be dangerously close to recession. Remember, the economy has grown by a little bit under 2% since Obama got into office. Hasn't really grown, but it hasn't been in a complete recession. It would be sad, or it would be disappointing, that a recession would start just when Trump comes in and tries to open the levers of business. But, you know, these businesses run in cycles. Here's a little bit from Peter Schiff.
Put the brakes on this rally, Peter.
Well, you know, the first time the Fed hiked rates, December of, 2015, the markets were giving the Fed the all clear, and then they tanked, right? We got off to the worst start to a year in history, and then the Fed backed off and didn't raise rates again for an entire year. Now, when they raised rates in December last year, it was in the middle of Trump mania, and so they kind of got a pass. But now we'll see. You know, this is a gigantic bubble. It's gotten a lot bigger since we elected Trump. Will this next rate hike prick it? I mean, there's a chance. I mean, eventually the air is going to come out of this bubble. So if it's not this rate hike, it's going to be something else. But, you know, you guys were talking earlier about the U.S. economy, oil prices. The economy is a mess. Look at Atlanta Fed is now looking for 1.2% first quarter GDP. It was at 3.4% February 1st. We are dangerously close to a recession in this country. Demand for gasoline is down. That's why oil prices are going down. And a rate hike is just going to, you know, make the problem worse.
So you're reading the data and you're looking at oil prices and decline that we've seen over the past few days as evidence that there is a slowdown in the U.S. economy. That is the result of a slowdown.
There's a lot of evidence. In fact, if you look beneath those, you know, window dressing for the manufacturing jobs that I think some of the manufacturers maybe added to curry some favor with Trump, look at what happened in retail sales. That could be the beginning of a huge trend. Why are retailers laying off so many people? Because Americans are shopped out. They're loaded up with credit card debt. They're buried under a mountain of auto debt and student loans. A lot of these retailers are going bankrupt. And these minimum wage hikes that we've been getting all around the country are just going to expedite the job losses.
But you've been singing about recession for a long time, and you've also been on both sides of this argument. You told me a couple of years ago that rates were going to the moon. Now you're telling me there's no economy, we're about to go into recession. Say what you want about pulling jobs forward or that there's the Trump buddy system going on here, but manufacturing jobs and goods producing jobs were at their best levels this month since 2000. And you get back to the PMIs, you get back to the services sector, and you can't tell me this is an economy that is sputtering here. If anything, the Fed would not be making the noise they're making if they have too much at risk.
Yeah, well, we just printed the highest trade deficit in 5 years. We have the highest inflation in 5 years. It doesn't sound like things are on track. Look, Janet Yellen is always going to try to put a positive spin on everything. But the reality is the economy has barely been growing. And in fact, I think if the government was more honest about the inflation rate, we would have seen that we actually have been in a recession. That's why Donald Trump was elected president, because the economy was so weak, people voted for him. But, you know, the markets are ultimately going to have to come to grips with this. As far as the Fed, look, the Fed wants to pretend that the economy is doing well, but look where we are. Look how long interest rates were at zero, and look how much they barely raised them since they started talking about it a few years ago.
All right, so you get the overall picture. Whether we're in a recession already or there's one around the corner is not good news, but don't forget when Reagan came in, and we had stagflation at that point, and it was a terrible situation economically. And he put in his market reforms, and he dropped the marginal tax rate down from 75 to 35, whatever the change was. It took a little while, but when the economy picked up steam, it was a very strong economy that was based on good fundamentals that created a lot of growth. And so it doesn't mean that we're going to be in free fall or anything, but you know, a lot of times in these transitions, it is also a time that the economy gets rebooted. So, all right. So looking for any other stories that you might want to chat about. And in the meantime, seeing if I can find you another comedy clip here. Some of these comedians are so ingenious. But so anyway, thinking about what we started with, and then, you know, getting into Obamacare, that's going to have to be done right. And there's a lot of I think I'm going to skip the comedy clip there's so much foul language in a lot of these comedians, just because you find one that's where there's one clip where it's not. I don't want to put on something that. All right, here's I have another one for you. But don't be afraid to call up Steve Pearson, let him know your feelings on the Obamacare change to Trump care. But, you know, we've got to be realistic. While Obama was running around lying to everybody, and Nancy Pelosi was off her medication, I guess, and full of crazy ideas and misinformation, the healthcare system itself was torn to shreds. And anytime you have a government intervention in a market, there's going to be damage, because, you know, people shut down businesses and go find something else to do. So the idea that you're going to change the law and it's going to repair itself in the next few weeks, next few months, that's not going to happen. It's going to take a while. Here's Jeff Allen, Love Languages.
You know, it was interesting. My wife and I read a book on love languages. Gary Chapman, an author, wrote Love Languages, and five of them. And we read it twice because we didn't see our love language in there. Bitterness and sarcasm just wasn't part of Dr. Gary Chapman's love language. So my son doesn't get satire. He doesn't. First time we watched Monty Python's Holy Grail, the middle of the movie, he's probably 12, we're watching it, and he goes, flesh wound? His whole arm came off. That's when we started to think he's a little different. So when he was falling in love with his now wife, we knew they were getting serious. We wanted to have her over to really get to know her better. So we invited her over for dinner, and they come running in one day, and my son goes, guess what we did today? I said, you pole vaulted first time. And he gives me the deer in the headlights thing. And she says, you guessed, first guess. And she looks at my boy and she goes, you said he wouldn't guess. He guessed it on the first try. Now he's looking at both of us with the deer in the headlights. I put my arms around her. I said, welcome to the family. I love you already. You got a lot of work cut out for you, don't you? Yeah, bless his little heart. He doesn't get much, does he?
All right. So let's see if I got a couple more texts here. If America wants to stay uniquely American, we need to follow the immigration laws on the books, accept into the country those immigrants who can explain how they will benefit our country and how they will contribute. We subsidize our own demise by our social welfare system, rushing to assist immigrants who come here to sponge off the system. Anyway, new Republicans-controlled Congress can move us in that direction. The sooner we can get back on track, tighten the borders, clean it up, etc. And them, oh, there, Frankie's lying on his closet floor with his thumb in his mouth and never Trump bumper sticker on his butt. Them good old boys from Tennessee had an attitude, still do. We'll have a great day. We're out of time. See you back in 22 hours. Ciao.